One can only appreciate the sea change brought about in 1965 if one understands what happened in 665, in 965, and in 1265. This is one of the fundamental points that I'm going to want to convey in the course of this lecture series. What is not necessarily what was. We could only understand the is if we understand the was. The contemporary world, with all of its nuance and complexity, can only be appreciated if one is aware of important aspects of the medieval world. You expelled us, we're back, and we're still here. In my previous lecture, I discussed Talmudism and philosophy as key elements of medieval Jewish intellectual history. I want now to turn our attention to mysticism, known popularly as Kabbalah, the third major focus of medieval Jewish intellectual history. I want to begin by stating, with not a small measure of embarrassment, that I really don't understand the world of mysticism, and I would even go so far as to add the words at all. However, there are a few points that I would like to make that I think have value and significance. First, I want to underscore a point that I made earlier, and that is that mysticism and philosophy obviously are very different from one another. The way mystics and philosophers think are very different, but they share one fundamental principle in common, a rejection of pure Talmudism, a rejection of all-encompassing emphasis purely on Talmud study. The Talmud and the law, the halakha that derives from it, outline what's necessary to do to observe, to act as a Jew, to ritually behave in accordance with Jewish law. But philosophers and mystics both understood that this was not enough. They claimed that there must also be an inner spiritual essence alongside the external behavior that they indeed did accept as being non-negotiable. Feeling and emotion and thought need to infuse routinized or externalized action with meaning. The active needs to be paired with the contemplative, the external with the internal, the practical with the transcendent. This today has important, significant contemporary resonance, and we find here echoes of the current emphasis of what we call today spirituality. In my introductory lecture, I noted that much of contemporary Jewish life is characterized by a personal search for religious meaning or spirituality. But while the details may be, and in some cases are unprecedented, the basic notion, the search for meaning in religious life, has a long pre-modern history. And it is this emphasis that we see both in philosophy and also in mysticism. Once again, we need to know what was in order to fully appreciate and understand what is. Another comment about mysticism. Mysticism, whether it is Judaism or in Christianity or in Islam or in Buddhism or in any religion, never emerges in the first stage of that religion. Religions come into being, you name the religion, and this applies, out of an experience of a great immanence, immediacy, closeness to the divine presence. In Judaism, God personally and directly appears to Abraham and to Isaac and to Jacob and to Moses. Christians and Muslims believe that God communicated directly with Jesus and with Muhammad. For Jews, God's presence was palpably obvious in the miracles leading up to and culminating in the Exodus from Egypt, in the revelation at Sinai throughout 40 years of wandering through the desert. Once in the land of Israel, God continues to appear directly to Joshua and to other prophets. They're personal conversations with God. And there are miracles, many, many miracles. In a word, the world was saturated with divinity. But the problem is that over the course of time, the feeling of the imminence of God begins to fade, and a sense of distance begins to develop. I don't feel God as much as I used to. Or more precisely, I don't feel God the way my grandparents told me that they felt God, the way they described to me this excitement and this closeness. I don't feel that. I don't feel God directly in my life. For the believer, this sense of estrangement is not just uncomfortable or unpleasant, it's actually intolerable and unbearable. I yearn. I can't live without closeness with God. And it is at this stage, you name the religion, any religion, that mysticism begins to develop. The clear goal of mysticism is to bridge the distance between me and God, to bring God more directly, more imminently into my life. And so therefore, all kinds of rituals and disciplines and meditations are developed to reconnect or to connect for the first time the devotee to God in a more direct way. In its desire to connect to God, Jewish mysticism constructed the concept of sfirot, suggesting that the way a purely spiritual, infinite, far-removed God was able to create a material and earthly world was through a series of emanations, that somehow the God-ness comes over the course of time progressively more material. We start from a purely transcendent being, and then slowly it gets closer, becomes more physical, becomes more earthly, until we actually have something called a world. The sefirot allow for God to be both transcendent and immanent. Yes, of course, God always remains way beyond human comprehension. But at the same time, God also becomes closer and more approachable. And this is what makes prayer possible. Prayer is impossible to a divine being who is totally removed and transcendent. I want to demonstrate this duality through the language of the traditional blessing that's recited before the fulfillment of a mitzvah. Follow along with me a little bit Hebrew, everything will be translated. The blessing begins, Baruch Atah. Blessed is you. You is in the second person singular. Then it continues, Blessed be you, O God, King of the universe, who sanctified us with his commandments. Asher kiddushanu b'mitzvotav. His is third person singular. But wait a minute. There is an inconsistency. Blessed be you, God, who sanctified us with your commandments. B'mitzvotecha. Switches in the middle, right in the middle of the sentence. It switches from second person to third person. We begin by speaking to God, you, directly. But we can't sustain the intimacy of the you. And we immediately step back and we switch to the more distant and the more formal third person. The imminence of the you at the beginning of the blessing quickly moves to the transcendence of the His by the time we conclude the blessing. Here we have a very clear, direct illustration of this tension. God is both immanent as well as transcendent, and both of them are important to us as we recognize and contemplate the divine being. Jewish mysticism began at the end of the Second Temple period and in the first century of the Common Era. There is no temple anymore. The repository of God's presence on earth has been destroyed. Even towards the end of the Second Temple period, God is slipping away. God is far. God is gone. God is distant. We feel the sadness, and we need to reconnect. It develops with great intensity in the 12th century in Provence or southern France. It was there that the notion of the Sefirot was developed, and Jewish mysticism, known as Kabbalah, began to flourish. In the second half of the 13th century, the book of the Zohar appeared. The Zohar became the most influential book of Jewish mysticism of all time. There's a great deal more that can and should be said about mysticism. I invite you to read Major Trends in Jewish Mysticism by the all-time high, most significant academic scholar of Jewish mysticism, Gershom Scholem. In the last lecture and a half, I focused on intellectual history. I spoke about Talmudism and codes and philosophy and anthropomorphism and creation and mysticism and immanence and transcendence and Sefirot. I now want to leave the world of ideas and turn our attention back to the reality of Jewish life under Christendom in the High Middle Ages from the 12th through the 15th centuries. The 12th century was a major turning point. It brought about a growing disdain of Jews. Until now, Jews, more or less, were an important people. Under the protection of important people, the kings, rights were clearly delineated. But now, after the First Crusade, and there were more crusades, the Second Crusade, the Third Crusade, it became clear that one can kill Jews with impunity. You can kill many Jews, and at the end of the day, doesn't really make a difference. Think Nuremberg laws, think Kristallnacht, think the Wannsee Conference. You could kill Jews and it doesn't really matter. But anti-Jewish animus that spread in the 12th century was even more diabolical. Until then, you remember that the Christian claim against the Jews in their midst was that they were blind and that they were perversely stubborn. We have seen the Christian argument, you remember, the argument of historical empiricism, that history has definitively proven the truth of Christianity. And the only way to explain the refusal of the Jews to go along with this is to know, to assume, and to know that obviously they're blind. And they're simply too stubborn to acknowledge the clear truth of Christianity. But now, in the 12th century, a much more dangerous and diabolical notion begins to emerge: the demonization and the dehumanization of the Jews in the consciousness of Christendom. Now, in the 12th century, Christians began to allege that Jews were actually demons, in fact, not humans at all, and don't act in accordance with normal human behavior. In 1943, Joshua Trachtenberg wrote a book entitled The Devil and the Jews. It was reprinted in 1966, and it's still very useful. It shows how Christians at this time in the 12th century began to see the Jew as a creature of an entirely different nature, of whom normal human reactions cannot be expected. In Christian eyes, the Jew was not a human being, but a demonic, diabolical beast fighting the forces of truth and salvation. And Jews were actually believed to possess certain physical characteristics, horns and a tail, which clearly set them apart from normal people and which clearly identified them with the devil. Most well known, and I'm assuming that many of you are familiar with this, is Michelangelo's statue of Moses in Rome, where Moses is depicted with horns. Now, Michelangelo comes to this honestly because the translation of a verse in Exodus that is understood to mean radiance was translated by the 4th century Latin Vulgate translation of the Bible as horns. So we have horns, and these horns and the tail become very significant in the 12th century as obvious representations physically of the fact that Jews are just simply not human beings in normal sense at all. It was also during this time in the 12th century that the charge first appeared that Jews ritually murder Christian children in order to use their blood in the performance of religious ritual. Most common, baking of matzot, eating during Passover. The earliest example of what became known as the blood libel occurred in Norwich in England, N-O-R-W-I-C-H, in 1144, where the Jews were falsely accused of killing a Christian boy by the name of William, who was found dead in the woods with multiple stab wounds. This was followed in 1168 in Gloucester, also in England. The first such case in continental Europe, and the first case where no Christian body of a child was at all ever discovered, was in the French town of Blois, B-L-O-I-S, in 1171. In that case, 31 or 33 Jews, it's hard to know exactly because you can't really read the manuscripts explicitly. There's a discrepancy in the sources. 31 or 33 Jews were burnt at the stake as a punishment for a crime that was never even proven to have taken place at all. This charge, the blood libel, was repeated dozens of times in medieval and modern Europe, starting now in the 12th century, and it persists even into the 21st century in a new Arab popularized version. But the Christian obsession with Jewish perfidy went even further than this. It was also during this time that Christians became convinced that Jews actually seriously believed some fundamental Christian ritual claims, in particular that of transubstantiation. Namely, that the wafer that is offered as part of the Eucharist service, that is called the consecrated host, in Christian belief represents the body of Christ. Jews were accused of desecrating or mutilating the host in an attempt to recreate the crucifixion of Jesus. In other words, for Christians, this is proof that the Jews actually accepted the notion that the wafer is the body of Christ, and now we're going to reenact the crucifixion all over again. These charges and other anti-Jewish libels set off waves of persecution of the Jews, so much so that at the end of the 13th century, a great rabbi by the name of Asher ben Yechiel lived in Germany, feared, and I paraphrase, that these flames of destruction would not leave a single Jew alive on German soil. The attitude of Christianity to Judaism underwent also another significant change in the 12th century. Up until that point, Christian anti-Jewish polemic revolved primarily around the Hebrew Bible. Christians argued, you remember from a previous presentation, that the Bible contained what I referred to as mystical prefigurations of Christianity. Jews argued against it, Christians argued in favor of it. It was the Bible, the Hebrew Bible that was the source, the crux, the focus of Jewish-Christian disputations. But now, Christian attention was turned to the Talmud, primarily due to the influence of a growing number of apostates, those who converted from Judaism to Christianity, who exposed their new Christian co-religionists to this work. At first, the Talmud was ridiculed. Strange, logic-defying stories, agadot, makes no sense. It's just simply foolish. But then, Christians also became offended by some of the laws that were contained in the Talmud, which they interpreted as discriminating not only against ancient idolaters, which is what the context was, but they claimed that it also applied to all Gentiles, including them. And then the claim was made that later Jewish literature, including the Talmud, originally actually contained proofs of the truth of Christianity, but the rabbis of the Talmud disguised them or deleted them. There were major disputations that took place in the 13th century, not primarily about the Bible, but this time about the Talmud, where the Talmud was literally put on trial. In the Paris Disputation of 1240, between the apostate Nicholas Donin and the leader of the Jewish community in that city, Rabbi Yechiel of Paris, and in the Barcelona Disputation of 1263, between the apostate Pablo Cristiani and the great rabbinic scholar Nachmanides or Ramban, the Talmud was the focus of discussion. In 1240, the Talmud was found guilty, condemned as blasphemous, and in 1242, it was burned in Paris. We know exactly where in Paris it was burned. It was burned in the very large plaza in front of Hôtel de Ville, which is the city hall of Paris. It's a magnificently open, beautiful area. I've been there a couple of times leading groups of American Jews focusing on Jewish history. I tell them the story of what happened right here, the burning of the Talmud in 1242. And we start to sing. And we sing, Am Yisrael Chai, the Jewish people is still alive. You wanted to burn the Talmud, the repository of so much of our knowledge. And here we are, we're back. And we're still studying this very important, significant text. It's important for us to recognize that these disputations were no simple, quote, debating societies where both sides were equal. The outcome was set up in advance, namely, the Jews will lose. If the Jews win, they lose. If the Jews lose, they lose. The Jews always lost. In the aftermath of the 1240 disputation, Rabbi Yechiel and other participants fled to the land of Israel. In the aftermath of the 1263 disputation, Nachmanides fled to Israel. In fact, there is a tradition that when the Jewish participants came to disputations with Christians, they would arrive wearing their burial shrouds, in Hebrew, tachrichin, under their clothes, because they never knew what was awaiting them. And it wasn't going to be positive. These disputations also reveal an important truth that we need to think about today. It was clear that Christians knew a great deal about Judaism, and it was clear that Judaism knew a great deal about Christianity, and yet they faced off against one another with increasing stridency. The lesson is important. Intolerance does not necessarily emerge from ignorance. I'm going to repeat that again. Important for us to think about. Intolerance is not necessarily a function of ignorance. The persecution of the Jews reached its peak in the middle of the 14th century when Jews were accused of poisoning the wells that led to a major plague known as the Black Death in 1348. It's very hard to believe this, but it is estimated that this plague killed between a third and a half, between 30% and 50% of the entire population of Europe. And the Jews were the ones who were blamed for starting it. And so the Jews suffer twice. First, they succumb to the plague like everybody else. And second, those who survived were killed in punishment for the Christian claim that they were responsible for bringing it about in the first place. So there was a terrible toll that this took, first naturally in the plague, and then murdered by those Christians who accused them of being responsible for it. Medieval Ashkenazi Jewry faced many, many serious challenges, but despite them, as we have seen, were able to create and sustain a very robust culture of learning, of life, of communal life, of intellectual achievement. In my next lecture, I will turn our attention to Sephardi Jewry, focusing first on Jewish life in Spain during the Middle Ages, then on the expulsion from Spain, the very famous, most famous expulsion of Jews from Europe, the expulsion from Spain in 1492, and then on the aftermath of that expulsion. Join me as we continue this, what I hope is a very important and exciting journey. Jews were discriminated against, Jews were expelled, Jews were persecuted, and Jews suffered. But thank God Jews are still alive. You expelled us, we're back, and we're still here.